Hello, and welcome to the Countercurrents podcast for the 9th of October, 2021. This is not Greg Johnson, but Millennial Woes. I am standing in for Greg tonight, and I'm here with Carl Thorburn. Hello, Carl.
Hello.
Excellent. So we're just going to do the usual and go through the entropy questions that have been posted, and also on DLive. We're also broadcasting on Odyssey as well, so if you want to watch there, that would be good. All right then, so let's get started. Okay. I'm going to assume that the questions from the 3rd of October were answered last week, and we'll just start on, we'll just do the ones on the 8th and 9th. So Sistofior says, thanks for all the great work you do. Keep it up. Thank you. Now, here's one from SF. Now, I wonder what you'll think about this, Carl. I wasn't sure about this question. I'll just read it out. There is a lot of nostalgia for the recent past in the distant right. Nostalgia for the recent past, which is surprising because the forces that brought us to the present were at work in the 80s and 90s. When I see a nostalgic video from the 80s, I think, if things were so great, how did they go so wrong so quickly? The problem with the distant right is that they see cultural decline as racial decline. They're nostalgic for the past because it was whiter, but their narrow racial focus blinds them to all the other ways that whites have declined and to how and when the decline began. Being nostalgic for the 50s because it was a whiter world is like being seriously ill with late-stage cancer and not knowing it is cancer, wishing for a time when you felt better but were still cancer-stricken. Do you agree that a failing of the distant right is its lack of a historical perspective that sees whites in decline from a specific episode in the past that brought us to the present? So basically, I don't really agree with this, because I think that there is nostalgia not just because the 80s or the 90s were whiter, but also because life was more straightforward. I mean, the racial thing is not the only reason. It's not the only way in which our societies have declined, and it's not the only reason that we're nostalgic for the past.
Yeah.
I don't think. What would you say about that, Carl?
I think that the world has changed so much in the last century that, and in particular since, you know, computers have become a thing, that all of these changes are sort of happening on top of the demographic changes. And because of technological changes coupled with cultural and demographic changes, it becomes kind of difficult to diagnose things, because you're trying to figure out, you know, okay, what's actually due to Jewish influence, or, you know, decline of white demographic or whatever, versus what's the result of, you know, technological changes. And I think that, I kind of agree with the question, because I think a lot of our troubles are coming from technological changes, which is sort of like the, you know, the Uncle Ted position.
I do agree that, without endorsing Uncle Ted, obviously.
Yeah, right. But I would say, yeah, though, I kind of take a, everybody always accuses me of being too optimistic, but I actually really do think that because of the fact that everything's happening at once, in other words, a lot of things are kind of overlapping, I get the feeling that we're going to be able to kind of parse this out in the future. Like, over the next several decades, it's going to become more obvious what's attributable to what. And I think that we're, the internet was such a huge change in culture and communication that it's likely that people growing up with it today are just going to sort of, because they've had it their entire lives, they'll sort of know better how to mentally compartmentalize it and deal with it. Similar to, like, you know, advertising and things like that. You know, modern advertising is rancid versus advertising that was in the 40s and 30s and, you know, 50s. But that's it. And I've seen I've seen written pieces about this, talking about I think there was a book called Simulation and Simulacra or something like that. Simulacra. I forgot the title exactly, but it's like a philosophy book written by someone. Yeah, I've
heard of it. Was it not Walter Benjamin?
I'm not sure. I think it was a French guy, actually, but I might be wrong. But basically, his idea was that mass media, kind of like starting with like radio, which was sort of the first example of mass media, it kind of causes creators and artists and producers of content to become sort of self-referential. And so what happens is that over time, instead of having references to the real world, you start to refer to art and parodies and recreations of the real world. And then people start to refer to that. And so it's sort of like you're kind of continually referencing things that are further and further removed from reality. And it's true, you know, like if you look at like memes and the way memetics works online, people become, I think that this is part of the reason that you see sort of a rise in mental illness generally, is that people, you know, the human brain was evolved to only reference the physical real world and not just like, you know, a mouse and keyboard, but like the actual natural world, like, you know, trees and animals and things like that. And so when the brain is confronted with advertising and computer screens and all that sort of thing, it starts
a natural way for us to live.
It actually kind of starts to load up your brain with stimuli that actually cause mental illness over time. And so, and you know, not all mental illness is equal. I mean, some of it's more subtle than others, but so I think that what'll happen is that, and this is just a theory, I don't know, but I think that over the next 50 years or so, technological progress as far as like media will sort of die down. In other words, it's not going to become the shift is not going to be as dramatic anymore. And that's going to allow people to have time to sort of get their footing and, you know, recognize what's happening around them and also kind of have a better understanding of how to raise their children. Because you're starting to see, like, even now, you know, young mothers who were raised on smartphones are kind of realizing, wait a second, maybe I shouldn't give my child a phone or an iPad or whatever. And so, I think that's sort of, that's going to be the future, I think, is that you're going to see people kind of starting to treat electronic media kind of like a drug. But anyway, that's a theory.
I think people will learn from their mistakes. I mean, all these, you know, Insta thoughts will not want their own daughters to be Insta thoughts, because they'll know exactly what a 13-year-old girl does when she gets an Instagram
exactly. Account. Yeah.
So, you know, of course there'll be equivalents for boys. I mean, you know, would you want your son to get addicted to video gaming and then spend his thousands of hours video gaming? Or would you rather ward him off that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and then also the other thing to think about is, like, you know, the idea that there's a big part of the right, I think, that sort of like has this idea that as each generation passes, it's automatically going to get worse, because the generation that was bad is going to be raising the children of the future, and they're going to naturally be worse, and it's going to continually, it's like tumbling downstairs or something. But that's, you know, if you look at history, that's not actually how things go. I mean, you know, there's been cases where terrible generations have existed, and then their children and grandchildren end up producing great art, you know, and actually kind of, contribute to civilization and growth in that way. So I think that there is, you know, much more potential for growth from here than a lot of people realize.
Yeah, well, I want to return to the question, which was, I mean, obviously we could talk all night about decline and regeneration and so on, but I want to focus on the question, because And I think you're right that we live in a way now that is not, that is very unnatural, very, very much a simulation. We're constantly confronted with simulations and artificial representations, symbols of real things and symbols of unreal things. It's not how we were evolved to live. So obviously there is going to be a lot of confusion and disarray. There's also just industry. We're now in a post-industrial society. We talk about modernity. We talk about mass production, mass communication, instantaneous worldwide communication, and travel, although not so much now with COVID. Mm-hmm. But all of this is not how we were evolved to live. Now, I mean, I think it's fair to say that we were evolved to live in like a, what's the number? Dunbar's number. I think it was 200 people or something in a village, in a small. And point is, I don't need to paint it too detailed. The point is that we are, it's understandable that we are, that there is a great confusion now. There's also the decline of religion, Christianity, which regardless of what you think about Christianity, the absence of it, the loss of it, yeah, has left people in disarray. So the reason I mention all this is I think these are there are many more reasons why people are nostalgic about the 80s, the 19th century, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. And there are even Zoomers now who are nostalgic for the 2000s, although that just seems incredible to me. But, you know, whatever. I guess it's going to happen. The point is, it's not just the fact that these were more, you know, these decades, these eras were more white than today, although that's obviously going to be a reason. It's all these other reasons as well. You know, life was less degenerate. There was less of a cruel, coarse edge to daily life than there is now. Yeah. There was less of the sort of nothingness that people seem to live amongst now, and the moral chaos. Life was simpler, more relaxed, more predictable, less chaotic in various ways. And again, we could go into each of those in detail, but I don't think it's germane to the question. So, yeah, these are all these other reasons. But the other thing is, I would say to the questioner, ASF, you can't blame people for missing the 80s, for example, even though the decline was already there, you know, because he sort of castigates people and says it's naive of them. Well, yes, it is naive of them, but it's still very human. It's very understandable. I mean, there's no point sort of saying to someone, ha, you idiot, you fool, feeling nostalgia for 1997 or for some nice memory you have of 1986, right. You know, because of course they're going to. It's kind of irrelevant.
Yeah,
that the decline was already there. I mean, someone's and you know, the metaphor he uses, someone is going to miss the early days of their cancer because it was less devastating then than it is towards the end.
Right.
Sorry, go on.
No, I mean, unless you had a terrible childhood, you're going to reminisce about your childhood. You know, you're gonna, you know, if you are lucky enough to live in the same area where you grew up, then, you know, every time you drive past the street that you grew up on, you're going to reminisce about that.
Absolutely.
But it's, I think that, you look at like, before Industrial Revolution, there was like periods of thousands of years where there were just almost no technological progress. You know, it's just sort of your generation was almost essentially had the exact same lifestyle as, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 generations prior. So
it's unimaginable for us.
Yeah. And you know, now, and I was talking to somebody else about this earlier this week. You know, now it's like disappointing to people if music doesn't dramatically change from one decade to the next. You know, like if you think about like the history of music, it's like there are easily identifiable dramatic changes in what's popular music. And it's sort of like we're kind of, I don't want to say that we're to the point that it doesn't change at all yet, but because of the sort of the splaying of all these different genres of music and the fact that we have like Spotify and Netflix and everything like that, and the fact that anybody can you know, cater to their own interests. It's almost like we don't have an identifiable, popular music for each period anymore.
Oh yeah, this is an amazing thing. I mean, sorry, go on.
Oh no, I was finishing up the thought, but basically, you could even make the case that that's almost the case with like films too. But I think that that's a good thing because what it means is that this sort of global monoculture that everything was trying to shift towards, it's not really going to work anymore because people are going to kind of go their own way. It's almost like they're going their own way, but they're still not completely divorced from the giant mass of the empire yet. But I think that as the economy falls apart, we'll see even more separation.
So yeah, I would have to say that I don't see any separation yet. I think that it is that this global monoculture, it has become stagnant because it's reached a certain plateau, a sort of generic perfection. And it's right. From their point of view of how a film should be, how a film of this particular genre should be, how a song from that genre should be. And really, it's there are only two genres. There's sugar pop and, R&B.
R&B,
which is just dreadful. But they've now reached plateaus and a sort of homogeneity. I've got a post coming up on Telegram in a couple of days about the new extension to the London Underground, which is incredibly generic. It could be in any city, any country, any continent in the world. There's nothing English or London or even European about it. So there's this sort of global standard that has been reached.
Now, but do you remember very recently there was I forgot what it was called, but there was a song that took off. It got really popular online and people were kind of making memes of it and sharing videos of people doing like a sea shanty song. And it was like everybody thought that it was the coolest thing, you know, that there's this, I don't know if it was like an Irish or a Scottish or something. It was a sea shanty. And these people were singing it. And for a while there, it was like, it was just, you know, it was the only thing that you would see shared. It was like on, you know, TikTok and people were doing stuff like that. And it's almost like people are getting sick of the monoculture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to move on to. I think that it does seem likely that people will tire of this simply because it is so, it's so boring and so hollow. And that's two different problems. The boringness, everything has basically been the same for the last 20 years. The hollowness, it doesn't relate to people's real lives anymore. So the other thing is, as if the global economy does collapse, as I think you and I both dearly hope that it does.
I hope that it does, but I will say that it also terrifies me just because, I'm not ashamed to admit that I'm heavily reliant on the global economy, so to speak. I mean, like it would be pretty jarring for me when it happens, but yeah.
Oh yeah. But the reason I say I dearly hope that it does is I think it's the only way that we're going to get out of this inertia, the Schwab, Klaus Schwab world, which is being constructed around us as we speak, which is, it's just terrifying. It's the only way we'll escape the pod. If you want to.
Here's another idea to think about. Lately I've been seeing pieces written about artificial intelligence and how it's getting to the place now where bots are almost indistinguishable from real people. Yeah. And so I think what'll happen is that you're going to have a saturation of the internet with very human-like bots, and you'll never know if you're talking to a real person or a bot. And I think at that point, it will be so devastating to people who are looking for real human connection that they'll have to abandon the internet. You know, they'll have to just, go eye to eye with real people.
Yeah. It'd be funny if even the bots were complaining about it.
Yeah.
It's like in the way that, you know, immigrants complain that, oh, there are so many immigrants here. I was expecting you.
Right. There's too many of these weirdo humans on here.
Yeah. So, I think that as things, if things do fall apart globally, then obviously people will revert. It's inevitably to more local cultures. I hope that does happen. But yeah, in the meantime, I can understand why people are nostalgic for the 80s, for the 90s. I certainly am. I mean, I won't deny it. I'm sort of embarrassed about it. But at the same time, I think I'm certainly not alone in this. And it is understandable.
Yeah.
And yes, of course, the decline was there in the 80s and 90s. But that's not my problem. I mean, that doesn't stop me missing those eras.
Right. And, you know, this kind of, like, not to take too long on this one question, but this kind of goes to something that I was going to mention, too. I wanted to make a point of this today, which is that, you know, a lot of people in our circles get black-pilled, you know, talking about, like, well, I'm living through the decline and things are going to collapse soon. And you really shouldn't be as black-pilled when you take into account the fact that this was set in stone, essentially, before you were born, right? Like, I mean, it's not something that just sort of began, you know, at some point during your life. This has been kind of ongoing for a while now. And I think that if you absorb that and you kind of accept it, then it makes it much more tolerable to actually live through the collapse.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's sort of counterintuitive because you'd think that would be overwhelming. It would be sort of drowning to think that your life is all within the collapse, or it's all within the decline. But actually, it does give a sense of perspective that really, my grandparents, they were within the even their lives, and that's why they continually moaned about decline. Because it was, you know, from their childhoods to their old age, there was a huge amount of decline that, and, you know, the loss of religion, the loss of local culture, the loss of nationality, etc. It was all going on 100 years ago, or, well, definitely 80 years ago. So, yeah, this is not something that sort of began in the 80s and progress and could have been arrested in the 90s if only we'd woken up.
Right.
It was all there very much in full flow. It's an interesting question, and I hope that we've given it a fair treatment. I hope that we've not been dismissive, but I think that SF is a bit intolerant of the way that people are, the way that people just are. Because I know him well. He's he posts questions on my own show quite regularly. And he's a very interesting guy, but sometimes I think he misunderstands. He's just a bit intolerant of human nature. Okay, we'll move on to the next question. And this is from Gadius Maximus, who's obviously known to this podcast. And he says, a Charlottesville case is set to begin near the end of this month, October. Some of these cases include folks that I'm not fond of. Yet I think it's important that they win these cases, because in the end, it's a fight against a common enemy. What do you gentlemen think about the concept of burying the hatchet in general for the greater cause? Carl, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I can totally understand why people, you know, have grudges with each other, and, you know, I tend to try to avoid that. And if I do end up being party to something like that, I'm not always the best at, you know, maintaining distance. But I think that if, you know, absolutely we should do as best as we can, or at least not antagonize people who are going through hardships, you know, because it's one thing if you're just sort of if your personal life is great, you know, if you've got lots of money and you're, you know, you don't have to worry about anything, and your family and friends are all in good health and everything, then it's easy to go around attacking other people because you just sort of assume that other people have easy lives like you do. And we shouldn't pile onto people because you don't know what they're going through. And in the case of Charlottesville, or the case of like the normie conservatives who were locked up for that January 6th, quote unquote, insurrection. I mean, you know, those people are really suffering. And so we should, even if we don't agree with them, we should sort of stick up for them, because who knows, you know, other conservatives will see that and they might think, oh, okay, well, they're being gracious, and so we should be gracious to them also.
That's an interesting angle, that this would also include right conservatives. When I mean, I don't consider myself a conservative, but I guess a lot of people on our side will. And the more centrist leaning side of that is mainstream conservatives. And you know, we have our own beefs with them. We could go on about that for ages. But I guess it's the question is, what are the odds of them siding with us ever? And you have to really try to size that up.
Probably pretty low, but I feel like recently, especially in the U.S., we go through this period every 4 years where conservatives are kind of duped into thinking that they've got any kind of power. And my hope is that enough of them will start to realize, especially after Trump, that via electoral politics, they really don't have any power anymore. And
that does seem to be the case. I mean, after that November election, you know,
once it becomes apparent that it doesn't even matter if your guy gets elected, because he's just not, you know, he's just going to put his son Jared, or his son-in-law Jared, in charge.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully those conservatives will at least start to kind of realize that we're kind of getting into the winter, so to speak, and it's time to start huddling together.
I would also say that within the movement itself, there's a need for unity. I think that unity is absolutely essential. You know, this is something that bothers me. It's on my mind an awful lot of the time, because, and it always has been. I remember, like in 2016, seeing people having pointless falling outs, bitch festing about each other, and it never helps anyone. It does help someone. It helps our enemy, and that's it. That's the only people who benefit from our infighting is our enemies, and I wish that people would really internalize that, because it's the truth, and it's very important. It's a very important truth.
Well, that was actually something that they said in I forgot which organization this was, but there was some organization that was published some paper somewhere in an obscure academic journal about how to demoralize and break up the dissident right. And one of the things that they listed was, you know, basically go in there and try to foment infighting.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's common sense. You know, that's what you do to your political enemy. Just don't fall for it.
Absolutely. I mean, if there are individuals who habitually seem to get into fights with other people, and they're constantly moaning about other people, they're constantly attacking other people, don't give them your attention. Don't give them your time. Don't give them your donations. Let them wither on the vine, because they are a destructive, damaging element at best.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they're not feds. But they might well be feds. But the thing is, if someone is indistinguishable from a fed, then, I mean, that's a pretty dreadful situation. I mean, and there are people who are, you know, they're so maladjusted that you would think that they must be a fed.
Yeah.
But they're not. They're just maladjusted. They're just nuts.
I've been accused of being a fed. It's funny. And it's like, you know,
I've been accused of being a Jewish transvestite.
Well, okay, so you've got me beat on that one.
I think they meant a fed as well. That was implicit.
Okay. What was that line from Monty Python? Your mother smelt of elderberries and your father was a hamster or something.
Yeah, you get these people who are. I mean, there was a YouTube channel called Transvestigations.
Okay.
I mean, just absurd. He was obsessed with people being transvestite.
Yeah,
it just upset this German autist who'd got it into his head.
Yeah,
basically everyone prominent was a transvestite.
Right. I saw that. Yeah, somebody had. I think that might have been him that did a post about. What's that girl's name? Taylor Swift. He was like, her hands are too big. It's like, okay, well,
that's crazy. I mean, yeah, well, I think there were several things I wanted to say about this, because the question was relates to burying the hatchet, and this is when you've fallen out with people and you then think, well, maybe it's not that serious, maybe I should overlook this and make amends. It can be very difficult to bury the hatchet with someone when they have attacked you and you have attacked them, and it's better just not to fall out with them in the first place. You know, it's better to just think, okay, is this person has pissed me off, but is it worth falling out with them publicly, especially publicly? Because you know, once it's public, it's, other people get involved, other people have to take sides, and it's just a nightmare.
Well, I'll tell you, it's almost like Twitter was designed from the ground up to create this type of thing. You know, it's amazing how just the format of Twitter is.
I'm so glad I'm off it. I don't miss it in the slightest.
I know, it's amazing. Like my mental health has improved since I'm off of Twitter.
I held on for a while. I had various sock accounts, but really, more than a year ago now, I got banned again, and I just thought, I can't be bothered. I'm not going to create a new account. It's a dying platform anyway. It just feels like a graveyard now, because all the people who used to be on there are gone, or they're on obscure sock accounts, so you don't even know who they are. But anyway, I don't want to go on a tangent. I would say it's better just not to fall out with people in the first place, if it's at all possible. Like, if you disagree, if someone's saying something and you disagree with it, that's really not the end of the world. The better thing to do, rather than go after them personally, is just to give your own perspective on the matter and not even mention that person who you disagree with. Then there's no chance of it becoming personal. Well, you reduce the chances of it becoming personal. Don't get bitchy. Don't get resentful. Don't get jealous. These are just tips I would say to other people who are newer to this than I am, because these are the problems. Now, the only exception is when you're convinced that there is an individual who really is bad for the movement, who is really like bad for the community. Someone who, and there are quite a few, you know, I have a list of a short list of people who I think are awful for the movement and for the community of content creators, and you know, I debate with myself whether to say anything about them in public, because the point is that can anything even be done about them? You know, because they will always have supporters who will side with them and will think that you're a really bad guy for saying anything about this person,
right?
So I don't really know what can be done, but I would say that you should warn other people about them. That just seems like common sense.
Sure.
But yeah, that would be the only exception. That's the only time that I would say that infighting is justified, as if you're convinced that there is someone who is relentlessly damaging, who's relentlessly destructive. Now, that is completely different from someone who you don't like or someone who you disagree with. That's a completely different thing. And that's
I think the dissident right has a particular problem with this because of the way the left works, is that, you know, their favorite tactic, of course, is to do the whole guilt by association thing. And so they'll say, oh, you know, you must believe X, or you must support X because this person said it in the past. And so we're constantly trying to figure out, you know, who we have to denounce or whatever.
I'll tell you what I would say about that. When do you ever see the left denouncing each other?
It never happens.
They only denounce someone for not being left-wing enough.
Right.
That's it. Other than that, we don't even hear, we don't know about their disagreements. It's something that they, for somehow, I don't know how they do this, but somehow they manage to keep their disagreements relatively private and secret. And we really should learn that because it's, I mean, do you want to win or not? And don't we have enough enemies attacking us from outside?
I suspect, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that part of the way they're able to keep their infighting private is that they're all being paid by the same handful of billionaires. And those billionaires are probably like, okay, if you start fighting with somebody else in the movement, your paychecks are going to get cut. Right. Yes. And so that's what's happening is they've got discipline from George Soros or whoever it is.
I suspect you're right, because there is so much more, I mean, vastly more money sloshing around on the left.
Right. That
I think it's a factor in people's decision making, whereas on our side, it just isn't. And what that means is that people don't have much to lose. The other thing is from you know messing around, and the other thing is that the left in this day and age attracts people who are conformists. It does attract fringe and antisocial people as well, but it seems to be mostly made of very conformist people. Whereas, and you know, 100 years ago it was probably different, but that's the way it is now. I believe. Whereas our side is made up of people who are not conformists, who are not going along with the mainstream, who are not going along with the orthodoxy. And so that predisposes them to being very independent, but also very disagreeable and willing to disagree, willing to. And I don't know what, because I know that someone hearing me saying this could say, you're saying that people should just go along with things they disagree with. Not necessarily. I'm just saying that they should learn to be more diplomatic so that there doesn't have to be some big falling out. Learn to negotiate. That's what I would say. I guess we are in a roundabout way answering the question, which is yes, it is better to bury the hatchet for the greater good, and usually it's also for your own good as well in the long run,
right?
But it's also, it's even better still is not to fall out with people in the first place.
Yeah. If you don't like somebody, just don't talk to them. Just kind of avoid them.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it.
Exactly. There you go. That came from Gadius Maximus. Now, here's a question that you'll be able to answer, Carl, hopefully, because I certainly can't. And this is from the Horatio Nelson. And he says, I have excess power from solar panels for about 5 hours a day. I can't store this power. Would it be worth investing in a Bitcoin mining rig, or does it need to be able to function 24/7 in order to be profitable?
Yeah, in that case, I would not, unless you've got like an absolutely massive amount of solar panels, like let's say your backyard is completely covered in solar panels. It's probably not worth it to do mining that way. You might be able to, depending on your utility, you might be able to sell it back into the grid. Some power companies will let you sell your electricity by pushing it back into the grid. And what they'll do is they'll actually, your little spinning electric meter on the side of your house will actually go backwards when you do that. It's kind of cool. Bitcoin mining is, a lot of people think that they can get into it, but I think there's kind of a misconception because they're thinking like it's like 2012 or something, because back then you could do Bitcoin mining with a decent computer, but nowadays it requires serious investment and you really have to run it 24/7 to do it. So no, I wouldn't. The other thing you could do is you could try getting there's a certain type of cheap battery, and it might be lead based, but it's called a flow battery. And you could just charge up your cheap battery during those 5 hours. And then that way, if there's ever a storm or a power outage or whatever, you could have backup electricity that way. But I wouldn't bother with mining with that.
Yeah, I was wondering. I was thinking that myself, that it would be worth him investing in a way to store that excess power. It seems like a resource that's just going to waste there.
Mm-hmm.
He also asks, do you have any other comments about mining rather than just Bitcoin?
Mining is not something I've ever done myself, but I've read a lot about it. And I think if you're bent on mining, if you really want to do it, the way to do it is going to be to look for altcoins that are kind of like smaller, newer altcoins that might have use a different mining algorithm that doesn't rely on graphics cards. Because if you could find something that doesn't use graphics cards, like for instance, it uses like GPU power or something, and you've got a computer laying around that's not, that you don't ever use anymore, that might be an option. But yeah, graphics cards now are so insanely overpriced. And just because of the chip shortage lately, due to manufacturing and COVID and all that, it's very, I mean, honestly, you would make more money just selling your graphics card on eBay than you would from mining with it. So that's what I would say.
Right. Okay. Now this one is from Steve. I won't read out the full name because I never know whether people want their full names revealed. So Steve makes a generous donation and he says, "Hello, Greg et al. I am unable to listen to your live shows most times, but enjoy the recordings. Thank you. Viva Velo." Well, thank you very much, Steve. And then one from Reed Johnson, and he says, "When men are in their worst shape, the phrase 'be a man' can either inspire or just make matters worse. As we cope with broken men and adrift young men, should we seek a certain balance between healing and toughness in dealing with them?" Yes, obviously, of course we should, because there is no point, castigating someone for if they're in a bad way. It's not a surprise that they're underperforming or letting themselves down or whatever. So, of course, there is a need for healing. There's a need for patience. There's a need for advice. But there is also a need for toughness. And I think that that's a threshold that is different for each individual case. It's something I did when I was a long time ago now, 15 years ago. I went through a crisis and it was the sort of first time that this happened to me. And I got better, but then I got complacent and stopped improving, stopped pushing myself to heal further and get out of this rut. I think that this is something that I see it with certain people in my own community, where they get better a bit, but then they're so pleased with that that they just stop. And they sort of say, okay, this is, I might still have a shitty life, but at least I'm not in despair anymore. At least I'm not a complete wreck now. So I'll just settle for this. But that's obviously not as much as they could do. So I think it's very important. And that's when you've got to be tough with someone who's being like that. You've got to then say to them, look, don't rest on your laurels. Don't get complacent. There is still further to go. You could still make yet more improvements. And this, this goes for all of us, really. So I think that there is a need for sympathy and healing, but there is also a need to be impatient for people to be their best. That's what I would say here. And that does mean toughness. It does mean not joining them in their complacency about their own situation.
Yeah. This reminds me of an article I posted. I think I posted it yesterday. It was about this in Australia. The media got excited about the discovery of a group of young guys who are getting together to lift weights. And they have mostly, not all of them, but they happen to mostly be white nationalists. And they were really scared because they were thinking, oh, these guys could potentially, commit a terrible crime with a lot of violence or something. And it's so ridiculous because there was absolutely no indication. In fact, they didn't even have, usually if you're going to write a big expose about a group like this, it would at least include some kind of a quote taken out of context in a chat group or something, you know, where somebody says, you know, something cruel, you know.
Yeah, someone says something that can be taken out of context, right. Misinterpreted. And,
right.
Yeah, exactly.
But in this case, they wrote this article and they didn't even include, like, there wasn't even that. So it's just sort of like they were just basically angry that a bunch of white guys were getting together to lift weights and improve themselves. But see, really what this gets down to is that I think that and this is something else that I'm guilty of that I wish I need to improve in myself, is that I need to start to get together and socialize more with people in real life in the dissident right. I do it on occasion. Like, you know, I've been to a couple of AMRIN meetings in Tennessee. But anyway, I think that that's sort of the key to improvement for anybody really, but particularly for men, is to have you have to get together with the same group of people consistently week after week. And that, I think, kind of leads people to improve themselves and help each other out. And that's, I think that's a big part of the reason that Christians and churches do so well, because Christianity and church is, you know, now obviously, you know, Christians will say, well, it's the gospel and it's discussing the Bible and things like that. But also there is definitely an element of just simply socializing with the same group consistently over and over. And the fact that you see each other every week and you catch up every week, that kind of influences you subconsciously to try to, okay, I want to look a little better next time, or I want to, you know, perform a little better each time. That's what's kind of missing now, I think, is that with the absence of sort of the Mannerbund or whatever people want to call it, that's why it's we're starting to see people kind of fall into this, you know, like video game and porn addiction and things like that. It's because they're just not meeting in real life anymore.
Yeah. There is that. I think there's also a sense in a lot of young men that they don't know what to do with their lives anyway. Even if they could get better, what would they then do? What career would they then have in this day and age? And therefore, what's the point of getting better?
Absolutely.
This is a very real problem. I think this is a very important thing. Because people have this, you know, it's a cliche that the boomers had it easy, and that's not true exactly. I don't want to, you know, have a go at the boomers, but life was definitely more straightforward then than it is now. And there was there were careers. There was the thing about getting it, just see if they're hiring. You know, the cliche memes.
Yeah.
Go and see if they're hiring. And if they are, maybe get a job with them, maybe get promoted with them, maybe get a transfer to a better post at a different company. There were careers. Whereas now I think that's much less of a thing. And also there's just more, I think the middle class has disappeared or is destined to disappear, because there isn't a need for so many professionals anymore. Because of automation and offshoring. Yeah. So I can understand that a lot of young, there are lots of neets now, whereas 20 years ago there weren't. It didn't really exist 20 years ago, as far as I know. It was a thing that emerged in the 2010s or maybe the 2000s. And now it's, I think in the aftermath of COVID, it's destined to become an even more prevalent part of just a feature of our culture, that there are loads of young men who are at home, who live with their parents, the basement dweller archetype, who's on, you know, video games all the time. I think that we should try to fight against that and not become that, even though it's very easy to in this day and age.
You know, one thing is that I've always been really jealous of people who, even like very early on in high school when they're teenagers, they know with certainty what they want to do for a living, you know, and those people, they tend to be the most successful, because from a very young age, they belong, they have a sense of belonging because they know exactly what they're going to do. The problem is that when you just, you know, you kind of wander through high school and college and even after, and you have no idea what you're going to do. And so naturally you kind of, I mean, this is what happened to me, is that, I was going to go the route of being a lawyer like my dad. And, but then I realized, I hate that. I can't stand it. I'm not like socially adept enough to be able to do lawyer stuff. And so at that point I was like, well, okay, maybe I can go into investments, maybe go into banking or something. But there were aspects of that I didn't like either. And it's sort of like, and so I went down several paths. I was even a chef for a while, but it was just like, if you don't know what you're going to do, life is really difficult, because it's almost like you're kind of in the middle of the ocean, like looking for a little island to land on. it's difficult. And I think that, if we had kind of like a guild situation where people could more easily do apprenticeships, that would be awesome. There's so many jobs out there too. This is something else I noticed, is that some of the most successful people I know have kind of weird jobs that you would never think about. Like, they're just like careers that you never even really considered before yourself. And so there's so many different jobs out there that most people don't even think of that exist, but because they're not thinking of it, and because they don't know anybody that does it, they have no idea to apply or to, try to study it and learn how to do it. And so that's what we need more of, is we need sort of more awareness of what there is available and what society actually needs.
And what you need as well as an individual, because the life of a neat is not, it's not what you were made for. And, almost any guy is capable of better than that. Mm. I think that some of them need to know that. They need to be told that, because I think a lot of them are quite down on themselves and think, well, this is all that I can do. It's a serious issue. It's a serious issue. I'm just going to paste the Entropy link into Odyssey. There we go. Because I should have done that at the start. I was forgetting about Greg's usual thing. That's it on Entropy. I can't do it on DLive, but... I think most of you will already know the link. Carl, if you can paste that onto the live, that would be good.
Yeah. Here, I'll send it over there.
Yeah. So let's see that is all of the questions on Entropy just now. So if people could post more, that would be good in order to keep us going. One thing I did want to say, something Greg always says is that there's only one way to support Countercurrents with a credit card. But there is actually a new way. I did mention it once. I want to mention it again. And it's called MoonPay. And what happens is you make a credit card donation, a payment, and it is converted into crypto, which then goes into the Countercurrents crypto account. And this will work for, you just need their crypto address and you paste that in. And into the MoonPay interface, and that will work. And that will work for other content creators as well, including myself, but really all of us. And that is a way to support us that I think will probably work for the long term. And so this is why this is an essential thing. This is something that we are absolutely going to, crypto, I think, is going to be essential if you want this movement to continue at all in the future. I think that this is the only way it's going to happen, unfortunately. So I wanted to make a point of that. It's called MoonPay, not MoonPig, MoonPay.
Is it M-U-U-N? Or
No, just
M-O-O-N?
Yeah, as it sounds.
Okay.
There it is. I'll paste this in so that people can find it.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a new thing, and that is a new way that you can support Countercurrents with with the usual credit card or debit card, bank card, that you can support anything else with. So it's unfortunate that we've been cut off from the mainstream and in the movement in so many different ways, and especially this way. But that is something that gets around it. So, Carl, if you could paste that into DLive as well, that'd be good. So that's something for you to consider, and please do consider it. So, okay, that's that. Carl, did you get any questions from the DLive chat?
CFO Malley says, given the Biden Department of Justice latest shenanigans on making life miserable for dissenters, do you think going to conferences like Amarin makes sense?
What was meant by this bill? What does it do to dissenters? Does anyone?
Not sure what he's referring to exactly. Was there a bill passed recently, or are they thinking about passing a bill? I don't know.
I've not heard about this. I would say that it is worth going to conferences, and especially because there are fewer of them nowadays than there were, say, 2-3 years ago.
Yeah.
And it is a challenge to organize an event at the best of times, but especially as it's a difficult thing, complicated logistics and all that, but especially for the likes of us, because the system is poised against us, and Antifa are a force that I don't want to use the too strong language here, but they are a destructive and intimidatory harassment sort of force in society.
Yeah.
And they do try to shut things down. They do try to attack people. They're horrendous. They should be utterly ashamed of themselves. And I wonder if some of them will be eventually. That's an open question. But in the meantime, go on.
Archie Bunker in the DLive chat just says that attending an Amarin conference is not the same as facing off with a school board. And I mean, he makes a good point, which is, you know, Amarin, you've never been to Amarin, have you, Woz? Because I guess you're...
No.
Okay, you've been to the... How many times have you been to the U.S.? Have you been...
Oh, just once.
And just the once.
It was 5 years ago, and I went to the NPI conference the Northwest Forum conference in Seattle.
Okay.
So it's weird because at the time it all felt so new, but now it's half a decade ago, you know?
Yeah.
I'm sure things will have changed a lot since then.
I went to Amarin the last two times, and I'm seriously considering going this time, but it's out in Western Tennessee is where they have it, and they have it in a state park. So it's kind of out in the woods, and it's far from any large metropolitan area. So you have to drive a considerable distance to get out there. And so it's, and not only that, but the state of Tennessee provides security for us while we're there. So it seems like a really safe one if you're going to go to it. I don't think that it's a dangerous thing to go to, or it's a bad idea to go to, because I feel like if the Biden administration or whoever decided that they wanted to hurt me or somebody else, they already have all of my information, right? Like I'm not contributing anything to them by attending a conference like that. So, I mean, you know, that's just the way I look at it.
Yeah, I would agree. And you know, Jared is very good at keeping his conferences safe. I remember that Antifa were actually kept a certain distance away from the venue, like quite far away, so that they weren't able to interfere or see the guests.
Yeah.
Jared is very good at doing that. So I would say that Amarin for sure, I would recommend that people attend Amarin.
Yeah.
The wider situation is more blurry, especially in Europe. It's I don't really know. I know that Patriotic Alternative have done conferences. Well, obviously they did two that I was at. I think more recently they've done other ones, but I'm not sure. Actually, I don't actually know. But the point is, it's not easy to do conferences, and certainly not even, I mean, it's incredible now, you know, when I think about the 2016 NPI conference, you know, there were Antifa there, but only about 20 or 30 of them. Whereas nowadays that would be absolutely mobbed. There'd be hundreds, thousands of Antifa there.
They know that they know that they're safe. You know, they can get away with almost anything now.
So, oh yeah,
that's why.
Yeah, even under Trump, it's amazing because we talk about Biden and this the Kamala administration, but even under Trump, Antifa were getting away with, well, you know, virtually murder.
Yeah,
it's astounding.
Trump was the you've heard that quote, "Speak softly and carry a big stick." I forgot who said that. I think it might have been Lyndon Johnson or somebody like that. Trump was sort of the opposite of that.
Yeah. It's sad now to think of just how utterly ineffectual he was.
Yeah.
Because the promise was in 2015 and 16 was so great. The cliche is that the swamp, he didn't drain the swamp drained him. I think that's basically true. He was overwhelmed by the powers that were ranged against him once they actually got into office. That seems to be what happened.
That's why I really, really hope. I'm crossing my fingers that if he does decide to run, again he's going to be kind of shunned by Republicans who are not going to fall for it. And hopefully, you know, if we're lucky, we'll get like a Tucker Carlson to run or somebody like that. Because even if Tucker doesn't win, and he knows he's not going to win, at least it's good to have him out there speaking, you know, drawing a crowd.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah. I think that's a good example of why the American right does need to band together. Because, you know, Tucker and Trump and our guys, all of this melding together in the way that the left melds together, would be a real force to be reckoned with. I don't think that would ever happen. And I don't think that Trump would ever do it. I'm just saying, in theory, if it did happen, it would be a very good thing for the right in general.
Yeah,
and it's depressing that it could have happened in the 70s, could have happened in the 50s, could have happened in the 90s, could have happened now, but the right just doesn't do this. Mm-hmm. And that's why it continually gets defeated by the left. And I, you know, to link back to what we were saying earlier, we can only hope that the right finally understand this, that you've got to stop being worried about being called a racist or a sexist or a transphobe, because this is how they continually crush you, and you win nothing and you conserve absolutely nothing.
Well, you saw Dave Chappelle just came out with a new stand-up comedy routine, which I haven't watched yet, but I heard that he basically goes on a tear through pretty much every, sacred cow of the left. and he even has a joke in there about, I don't know if you posted this or not. Maybe you did.
I didn't. I think I did see it though. This is where he says that maybe the wrong side won the war.
Well, he said something like about, he said he had an idea for a movie, and the movie was that these aliens would come to Earth and would try to claim the Earth for themselves, and that they had originally been Earthlings themselves thousands of years ago, but they were exiled. They were kicked out of the planet, and then they came back. And he said that the title of his movie was going to be Space Jews. And so the audience, you know, didn't know whether to laugh or to gasp. It was kind of funny.
Good hell.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the skit. I've only seen these bits from it. It's something to, I'll have to look up. There's a new question from Red Line, and he says, it's sort of related to what we were just saying. Do you think there will be a split in the American left once the COVID nonsense dies down? First of all, I don't know for sure. I'm not sure that the COVID nonsense will die down. That's that's a sort of critical thing here, because I think that the powers that be want it to go on for as long as possible. And I think that they also have a plan for when it does die down, they'll replace it with climate change. And I also suspect that they'll try to ensure that COVID is never, that it's never known or realized that COVID was a big scam, a big trick. because in the same way that other historical events are not just defended in retrospect, but even reinforced and exaggerated in retrospect, I think that they'll probably do the same thing with COVID, where they'll say, oh, millions of people were dying every month from COVID. It was slaughtering whole generations, slaying the children. And I can imagine them really ramping it up, even in retrospect, so that people's memory of it is, it is actually even more extreme than the reality, than what we lived through.
Yeah.
Because they were exaggerating even while it was happening. Even while we could see that there weren't bodies piling up or people dropping dead all around us, the media was giving us a simulation, a simulacrum that was completely fictitious.
What's really distressing is that, we had access to all these publications talking about, the actual data for in terms of talking about like the mortality rate of COVID for each age group, and also the effectiveness of the vaccine for each age group and that sort of thing. And it's like, despite having all of this data, you could make a very strong case that the vaccine wouldn't benefit anybody at all, especially anybody under the age of like 70. But despite all that, it was still, the left was still sort of pounding this idea that you don't trust the science, or you don't believe in the science, right? And I mean, I'm kind of loath to even call it a vaccine, because it's not even technically a vaccine. I mean, like, it's kind of annoying that they, the left always does this. They always, the mass media will call something a thing that it's not. And then, everybody, including the right, picks up on it and starts calling it that thing. It's not a vaccine. It's some kind of RNA injection. I don't know exactly how you would define it, but it's some sort of an RNA therapy thing. And even according to the most optimistic papers that I've seen, it really is only effective for maybe like 3 or 4 months after you get it. And so,
why they're saying about the boosters. They
want the booster, I mean, like that would be disastrous, because, you look at like the posts on Reddit of these COVID people who are obsessed with the vaccines, even they're anxious about having to re-up with a new booster. They don't like the idea of that. And so they're going to start losing support over time. But I think what might happen, and I really hope this doesn't happen, I'm hoping and pray that the left just decides to drop this. But, it's totally up to them, because the right's not going to, the right has no power. So,
But I'm not sure that the left is the correct phrase here, because I don't think it's the left as such. I think it's the globalist powers that be, the money power. Big pharma, big tech, the deep state, the cathedral. These seem like, I know that people have got objections to the term the cathedral, but you know what I mean. These are terms that I think are more applicable than the left, even though I know why you use that phrase and I use it myself. But I think that a critical part of all this is that it's no longer really the left. The left is the bitch, of another power. Yeah. And I guess that people join the left for similar reasons to, what they've always joined it for, certainly for the last 50 years, which is that they profess to care about, even as I say these words, I realize it's not really true anymore. It's definitely not about looking after the working class, but it is about looking after what they see as the marginalized, the immigrants, the refugees, the homosexuals, the transsexuals, non-binaries. So it's looking after the marginalized in theory, in their minds. So I guess that people, but then another part of the left is really not about caring at all. It's very vicious. It's very hateful. I mean,
it's a really kind of, and it wasn't always like this. I think that the left was a little bit more straightforward in the past. You know, it's like now, ever since the corporate world has really sort of, you know, taken over the left. It's sort of like this weird tapestry of all these different groups that are, you know, you've got your billionaires and you've got your, you know, impoverished transsexuals. I mean, it's just all over the map. but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is also very hateful. That's the thing. It's not caring. I think that they tell themselves they are caring, and they hate people who aren't caring. They hate the hateful. Yeah. They hate the racist. Yeah. They hate the person who doesn't care about granny getting COVID. They hate the people who are getting in the way of progress. And it is a real vitriolic hatred. I mean, it's like visceral in a way that I think few people on our side are really familiar with. I don't think we really have this visceral hatred of other groups. Now, obviously, there are some of us who do, but I think most of us don't. But I think it's a very common thing on the left, and something they're even encouraged to feel.
Well, I think, you know, like normal mainstream conservatives, they actually, many of them still think that the left are just stupid. You know, okay, if you think that they're stupid, then what does that make you? You're the one that's losing to them.
Yeah, this is an amazing cope, and I've talked about this extensively on my own show this year, where the right always underestimate the left.
Yeah,
there was a man called Derek Turner who was involved in the movement quite a few years ago, and he said that the left is like a clown with a knife. And what the right do is they see the clown and they think, oh, it's just an idiot. It's just someone who's behaving randomly and foolishly. But they don't realize that, you know, he is actually holding a knife.
Yeah.
And he is going to use it.
And you're right. That's another thing. They also accuse the left of being kind of random and crazy. And it's like, well, wait a second. If they're random, then why is it that every single one of their policies ends up being anti-white? It's like, is that just a coincidence?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And also, if they're random, how is it all consistent? I mean, relatively speaking, it's fairly consistent. They're constantly breaking things down, constantly disintegrating power structures and so on. And if they're crazy, then how do they keep succeeding? And how do you, the conservative, keep losing? But it seems to be like a coping strategy for the mainstream right.
Well, it's like, and you know, this you could also point out the fact that the Republicans in the U.S. are convinced that anytime a Democrat wins an election, it's because of rigging, you know, or they had fake votes somewhere or whatever.
Oh,
right? And it's like, you know, okay, well, if we accept that and we say, okay, the reason Trump lost is because of, you know, vote rigging or whatever. I mean, for all I know, that might be true. I'm not coming out saying that I, you know, have proof that it's not the case. But what I'm saying is that even if it is true, okay, so that means the Republicans, the only way they can win is if they rig it in their favor, or they do a better they do a better job of rigging than the Democrats do. So it's like, you know, if you're going to accuse electoral politics of being you know, falsified, then you have to essentially just either develop your own superior falsification abilities, or you have to throw up your hands and say, okay, democracy is over. We're done with that.
Whereas what the mainstream right do is they complain. They complain that the other guy isn't following the rules. They're sort of appealing to what they believe is a higher arbiter who will arbitrate in their favor. But there is no higher arbiter. You know, this is the problem with many problems with the mainstream right, but one of them is that they sort of assume that everything is, the system is fundamentally as it should be, and this ne'er-do-well is breaking the rules. So the system will surely notice that eventually and stop him from breaking the rules. But that's just a completely delusional picture of the situation.
I wonder if that's part of the psychology of being a devout Christian. Maybe the right tends to think that
there's... You know what? It could be, but I think it's more to do with just the conservative psychology, which is very lacking in imagination. Right. I think they just don't see that they cannot imagine a situation where things are wildly out of kilter. And so they can't see that that is the case.
Yeah, it's a lack of imagination. Yeah.
I would say so. That's my own interpretation. I'm not saying that that's definitely the truth, but I think that's the case. And another one of these copes is the whole thing about go woke, go broke. That's another one where they've been saying it for years, and yet all of these corporations are still going strong. They're going very strong. And I saw a thing today, Black Pill shared it, that Sports Ball, hold on a minute, I'll find the exact thing. Go woke, go broke is a myth. The clapping seals want their sports ball. NFL ratings are up 17%. That's its highest level in 6 years.
See, I was kind of excited about that, because last time I checked that, I saw that the NFL ratings were plummeting ever since they had done the Black Anthem or whatever at the beginning of it. But
I could imagine that it would plummet for that first year, and then the next year, the audience will think, "No, I miss my sports ball. I can't make this stand anymore. I've just got to return to it. So I need my sports ball." You know, so
it's like a chemical withdrawal, where the longer you are away from it, the more you crave it.
Yeah, I think it is. So that's the other thing is the go woke, go woke. It's just a complete delusion, and conservatives seem to hold on. And you see this even in like newspaper comment threads on their websites now. They've still got this assumption that this will be their undoing. They'll get their comeuppance now. They'll realize that they never do. And I don't understand this, actually. I don't understand how these companies don't go broke. Because you would think, in theory, the audience are going to rebel against this. They're not going to like this. They're not going to keep buying this product. But for some reason, they just do.
There was a period in when I was in college back in like 2007, where I think that was when what's that guy's name? The New York Times had just published something about this. This blogger, I think it was called Little Green Footballs or something. He had figured out that Dan Rather had on 60 Minutes on CBS had falsified some documents or something related to John Kerry when he was running for president. And so the New York Times was all in on John Kerry, and they had published this stuff. And then this small time blogger figured out that it was a falsification due to like something having to do with the typewriter at the time was not using the correct font or something, or that font had not been created yet. And so it was really clever, but anyway, so then everybody in the comment sections on all the conservative websites were like, this is finally going to be the thing that kills the New York Times. The New York Times is finally going to go bankrupt. Right. And it's like, okay, so what happened was the New York Times, the stock did plummet and they did start losing a lot of money. But, well, what happened next? Okay, well, then Carlos Slim, who's a Mexican billionaire, came in and bought it, right? So when you have a newspaper or a media property like that, it doesn't matter if it makes or loses money, because it's sort of like owning a giant billboard that everybody goes in front of. It doesn't matter if it's profitable or not. You get to use it to manipulate politics to your will. And so that's the thing, is that these billionaires, you look at like Jeff Bezos now owns the Washington Post. Everybody knows that Jeff Bezos owns the Post. It's not secret. The Washington Post will publish articles all the time that, you know, are clearly obviously meant to benefit Jeff Bezos, either directly or indirectly. But nobody cares. And, you know, of course, people will point it out, but it's just, it doesn't matter because ultimately it's a media property that's like owning, you know, Boardwalk and a game of Monopoly. You know, it's, and so that's the thing is like, we're sort of, you know, we're kind of living through a period where, and this is another thing about conservatives, going back to talking about conservatives, is that a lot of conservatives are under the impression that and a lot of libertarians are this way too. They think if a high enough percentage of the population knows something about the elites, like that they eat children or something, or, you know, or that they are, you know, or
lizards,
Satanists or whatever. Yeah. That suddenly that will transform society and that they'll lose power. And it's, couldn't be further from the truth. You know, like a huge number of people hate billionaires and hate the elites, but it doesn't change anything. I mean, you know, what actually changes things is having access to the halls of power and creating media, right? Like that goes back to like eyeballs and what, you know, what people are looking at.
It's full spectrum. It's dominance of the airwaves is what matters here. And I agree with what you're saying about these properties, these media properties that are too big to fail. So they will be rescued from financial troubles because their real value is not their dollar value. Their real value is in their reach.
Right, right.
So whatever it costs, it doesn't really matter. It's worth it, even if the Guardian newspaper in Britain is constantly teetering on the verge of bankruptcy, but it keeps getting rescued because it's needed by certain powers.
Or like Yale and Harvard, you know, Yale and Harvard flood their student bodies with blacks and unqualified young women, and then that, you know, naturally causes the scores to plummet, but it doesn't matter because they've got the brand name Yale and Harvard.
And that's enough of a thing in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, to return to the question, do you think that there will be a split in the American left once the COVID nonsense dies down? I think no. But I think, well, yes, there will be a split if that happened. If that happens, yes, there would be a split. But it would be a small split. It wouldn't be the left just decimated, devastated by this. It would be a small splinter group who cared about the truth and were outraged at what had happened here. That this was all a big trick.
Right.
This was all a big scam. There are people on the left who are principled and they care about this and that, and they're suspicious of corporate power. They're suspicious of billionaires, you know, like leftists are supposed to be. There are some who are actually like that. And they, I think, would be outraged if this were revealed to have been a scam. I guess implicit in the question is also an assumption that the COVID nonsense is holding the left together here and now. And, do you have anything to say about that, Carl?
I think that's, you know, the left needs a group to hate, and it's easy to hate people who don't want to take a vaccine, you know, and, but I don't know that that's the glue that's holding them together. I think that the real thing that holds the left together is just sort of this vague, anti-white hate. Because if it were the COVID thing, then you would see much more agitation toward blacks who refuse to get the vaccine. And blacks, as a percentage, tend to be the group that is most resistant to getting the vaccine. And, you know, they don't face any pressure. So, I think that what will really split the left, if I had to guess, is most likely going to be a severe economic downturn. That's the thing that's going to shake up politics like crazy. And, you know, I think that the elites know that, you know, and they're probably trying to prepare for it, but I don't think that they're going to be able to really.
Sorry, what did you just say would be the real downturn?
I think that a severe economic collapse, like a severe recession, will be the thing that splits the left and it'll shake up politics. I think it'll not only it'll split the left, but I think it'll also split the right. I think that it'll be really, really dramatic and difficult for the elites to control the outcome of that. Right. So they, you know, they're very good at sort of preempting political trends, I guess you could say. They try to preempt it and take over. I don't know they're going to be able to do it with this coming breakdown. And it's just something that I think that it's going to force a lot of people's hands. But that's, and you know, that's something I could go on about for a while, but it's just,
I think you're right that the situation just now does rest on economic, it rests on luxury. It rests on people being comfortable and in plenty of money flowing, sloshing around. So I think you're right that if, and I've said this for years, a lot of people have said this for longer than I have, that a serious economic upheaval would be what disrupts all of this. Mm-hmm. So I think that's true. There is people just don't care. You know, if they've got their sports ball and a supply of whatever they want, whatever their favorite things are, then it's amazing to think of it, but they really just don't care if the world is falling apart.
Yeah.
As long as they've got their own comfort. That seems to be what most people are concerned with. And, you know, for the likes of the people who are in this movement, that is an incredible attitude to have, but it does seem to be how the normie thinks and feels.
Well, we're starting to see right now kind of like the first flickering of what a real economic crash would look like, because it's not about like losing your job or not having enough money or whatever. What it is it a real crash is where it doesn't matter how much money you have or even what the money is worth. What matters is the fact that when you go to the store, the shelves are empty. There's just not, you know, the supply chain is broken down. Basically, you no longer have access to things that you want, even if you're able to pay for them. And I think that's coming, and I think that'll be where people start to lose their patience. It's sort of like the opposite, like, you know, like right after 9/11 in the US, there was a period where everybody was kind of on the same page and everybody was pro-America, and that was the height of George W. Bush's popularity or whatever. And now an economic crash would be like a total 180 of that. I think that an economic crash would be sort of like where you would see people begin to consider fractures within society and breaking up the country, because people are going to have less sympathy for the poor because they're going to say, well, I'm poor too, you know, and I don't want to have anything to do with these immigrants. I don't have any sympathy for immigrants because, you know,
I've got my own problems to deal
with. Right, right. I've got my own issues. And it's not going to be a matter of like just getting money. And that's the thing, is like inflation, you know, and deflation, like people have this idea in their heads that it's just like where prices start to tick up and it starts to become more expensive to like buy a steak or whatever. And that's kind of true, but like, the reality of it is that, you know, in a real depression situation, like in 1929, it's more about the fact that you lose workers because people simply aren't getting paid enough to support themselves. And they're just like, well, you know, if I can't support myself and I can't buy the things I need, then why should I even show up to work anymore? And so it's sort of like a, the money is like the signal, and the economy itself is sort of like the decoherence from the signal. You're losing the signal. And that's what leads to hyperinflation eventually, because the solution, of course, is just to eliminate the debt by, you know, lately they've been talking about creating a platinum coin that has $1 trillion stamped on it. And that if they create this $1 trillion coin, that'll solve America's debt problem. And it doesn't solve the issue because and a lot of PhDs even believe this nonsense, right? You know, like you got like economists and PhD economists who are called MMT, modern monetary theory. They believe in this theory that the way our system is set up now, you can basically just endlessly cancel debt and endlessly inflate your way out of the problem. And
isn't this just printing money just in a,
it is, but it's what they do is they hide behind all of these layers of obfuscation, right? And they're saying like, well, you have to understand that there's a bond market and bonds freely float and you only have to pay a coupon on it every so often. And there's different tiers of bonds. There's like the 30-year and the 10-year and whatever. And it's like, but it's like, this is all distraction because ultimately, you know, creating a $1 trillion coin is no different from printing a $1 trillion $1 bills. When you cancel a debt, that's the exact same thing as printing money. If you default on a debt, the economy has to take into account the fact that debt is no longer required to be serviced. And when you don't have to service a debt anymore, that frees up money in other parts of the economy. So, you know, just the idea that you could just throw up your hands and say, oh, well, we're just going to reset the debt now and, you know, we'll cancel it. It sounds good on the surface, but the fact is that causes markets to hyperinflate in other areas because they suddenly have access to cash that would have been used to pay the debt down. So it's, you're going to get hyperinflation no matter what. And these academics, their job essentially, I believe, is to convince midwits who don't really understand economics that well to hold on to their dollars, right? Because as long as people have faith in fiat currency, they'll hold on to some fraction of it and instead of, you know, abandoning it for other assets. And so the hyperinflation won't come right away. Hyperinflation, it's not going to work out like people think it'll work out. Like it's actually more like biflation, where you get some assets that are like that you buy on a daily basis, like for instance, gasoline, gas to heat your house, electricity, clothing, all these small ticket items that you buy on a daily basis. Those items are going to go up in price a lot, larger items like homes and appliances and cars and things like that, those items will actually go down in value. And the reason they'll go down in value and they'll crash is because, think about it, let's say you're a boomer and you have like two or three houses, right? You have like a vacation home or something. And suddenly the price of food starts going crazy. What are you going to do? Are you going to hold on to your vacation home? No, you're going to sell your big ticket item that you don't need anymore. You might sell one of your cars. You might sell one of your houses in order to raise money so that you can continue to eat at restaurants and you can continue to buy nice clothes, right? And so the fact that you're selling these big ticket items to maintain your day-to-day standard of living, that causes those big ticket items to plummet in price because the market is flooded with a bunch of homes and stocks and, you know, just cars and just a bunch of items like that. So it's going to be a weird situation. It's not going to be straightforward where everything just goes up in price. It's going to be kind of wonky. Some prices will go up a lot. Some will go down a lot. It'll be crazy.
You said earlier about supply shortages, like the supermarket shelves being empty. What do you think about this theory that the elites are trying to crash the economy by engineering supply line shortages just now?
I've thought about that and I've considered it. And, you know, it seems totally plausible. But at the same time, it's like if the elites really wanted to crash the economy, they could do it pretty easily. All they'd have to do is just raise interest rates. So it's very strange what we're going through right now. I'm sure that the elites have some plan. They're definitely, you know, they're definitely not just doing this for the fun of it, right? They've clearly got something going on, something up their sleeve, right? But it's from my perspective, it just doesn't it doesn't make sense right off the bat what they're doing. I think that you know, the best we can hope for is just to make sure that you've got a place to live and you have a circle of support. And, you know, you have, ideally you have something that they just can't produce a lot of, like, for instance, Bitcoin or, gold or something that would have some sort of intrinsic value, like, you know, even just vehicles. It's funny, like I had a chart that I posted recently of, used car prices, and it's crazy. Like, there's actually an index that tracks the price of used cars, and it's at an all-time high right now. It's gone parabolic because everybody wants to get a used car because they're having difficulty manufacturing new cars because of the chip shortage. So, people get scared about crashes and stuff. And it's like, I would say to people also, like, you know, you shouldn't be too scared about a crash because, they're never a permanent situation, right? The 1929 crash, the big one that everybody remembers, the only reason that thing was so protracted and so painful is because the Federal Reserve was brand new at the time. And at the time, they didn't really know what they were doing as far as like fixing the problem. They had basically set up a system where the money was debt-based, and all of a sudden everybody was defaulting on their debts, which means essentially that money was being destroyed. And when you destroy money, that increases the value of the money. So it was inflating the value of the dollar. The dollar was going up. And so they didn't realize that in order to save the economy, they needed to print more money, right? That was the solution to the 1929 crash, was the Federal Reserve should have been printing enormous amounts of money. They didn't do it. And so I think this time around, they know they need to do that. And that's the reason we have such low interest rates. And, you know, also this time around too, we have another bout of what you would call secular deflation, which is like where you have, there's two different types of deflation. There's like unnatural deflation, which is where you have a crash and that's caused by the government doing something stupid that they shouldn't have done, like in 1929. But there's also a second kind of deflation, which everybody knows about, which is called secular deflation. And that's where prices naturally kind of decline over time because of technological progress. So you've got, you know, robotics and computers and all that sort of thing constantly kind of pushing prices lower as the economy gets more efficient. Well, we're having a period now of secular deflation, and that's means that the Fed needs to print more money, and the Fed really has no choice. They've got to print. And that's part of the reason, of course, too, that's part of the investment of Bitcoin. That's part of the thesis there, is that the Fed being kind of painted into a corner where they have to print, and all central banks do, right? It's not just the American central bank. If one central bank is printing, then every other central bank is sort of in competition with that one. And they're all in competition with each other because no central bank wants to have the strongest currency. Having the strongest currency is a bad thing for a nation. You want to have ideally one of the weakest currencies, because that means that you're going to be able to export to other countries. If you have a really strong currency, then your exports are going to be shot and you'll lose jobs. So Bitcoin is sort of a solution to all this, because it being a non-government currency that's not really tied to any one nation and not having a central bank, it doesn't really have to worry about inflation. It doesn't have to worry about keeping up with that. So it can deflate until the cows come home and it's no problem. But anyway, I digress.
But of course, there's so many variables. It is a very difficult thing to predict. And also, you can't predict how powerful the cathedral is at holding the left together, and even in the face of disasters that would, in theory, animate the left. Mm. We don't know. Okay. Archie asks, massively taxing the elite and having the new international corporate tax rule will help local communities decide what to do with the taxes instead of philanthropists having so much control about where their money goes, hence politics. Well, yes, of course. But that seems like a sort of hypothetical scenario there where we massively tax the elite. Obviously, you would want to keep money in local areas so that each of those areas had maximum autonomy to sort out its own affairs and was not dependent on the globalist system or even the national system. So, I completely agree. And it does seem that we have a cadre of billionaires and very wealthy philanthropists who don't really know what to do with all their money. And all they can think of is, well, what they're told to do with it, which is donate to LGBT, pro-migration, pro-multiculturalism, diversity causes, which just perpetuates all of these problems.
So, well, I think we're, you know, like even if you set aside the race issue, like even if you just completely ignore race, we're kind of reaching a point now where collectively humanity as a whole has to figure out what to do with these billionaires, right? Like we've reached a place where it's like one man's margin is another man's livelihood, right? So you've got these capitalists that are constantly trying to increase their profit margins just a little bit. Like if they can get an extra cent here and there, right? They're willing to shut down a factory and cause hundreds of people to lose jobs in order to eke out that extra little cent of margin, right? And that's a fundamental problem with capitalism, you know? And it's like, you know, capitalism is great for making people's lives more convenient, but just because your life is more convenient doesn't necessarily mean your life is going to be easier. I think that this is something that Norby conservatives have to come to grips with, is that we're going to have to eventually solve the, or what would you say, answer the billionaire question. You know, it's like, how do you deal with these people? And right now they're basically going on joyrides to space. You know, I mean, Jeff Bezos was in space for literally 60 seconds. You know, I mean, just to be able to call himself an astronaut. I mean, like, how insane is that? Can you imagine risking your own life and spending hundreds of millions of dollars to go into space for 60 seconds? Like, what kind of insanity is that? God.
Yeah, but also I doubt that his life was in much danger. I mean, I suspect it was made as sterile an experience as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
So that, you know, and I wrote a post about this on Telegram, and so did Aureus Press.
I still wouldn't do it. Like, you couldn't pay me to get on a rocket. I mean, you know, from what I've heard, and this is another thing, like, this is a total aside here, I'm sorry, but a lot of people think that rocketry is like the future and that everybody's going to be flying around on rockets, you know, like Elon Musk or whatever. But it's so stupid, because the way they don't tell you is that in order to go on a rocket, you have to wear a diaper, because not only are the G-forces insane, but also the vibration from being inside of the capsule is astronomical. And most people, have uncontrollable bowel movements in a rocket. So no, it's never, ever, ever going to become a mainstream thing. That's stupid.
Right. I suppose that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
How did we get onto this? Oh yeah. So what to do about billionaires? Of course. We have a system here where people are able, a small number of people, admittedly, but some people are able to become unimaginably rich, and then that, I mean, I don't know. I honestly don't know. It is, because if the right people were getting rich, you know, then things would be different. So is the problem that some people are getting spectacularly wealthy, or is it that, you know, the cathedral is in place to influence them and tell them what to do and what definitely not to do with their money? I don't know. I'm not sure. But clearly there are problems inherent in a tiny amount of people getting rich, which is the inequality that people moan about, understandably, that we have this tiny minority who are just astoundingly wealthier than the average. And I don't know. I mean, I'm definitely not left wing in that regard. I'm not against some people being very rich. But I think that isn't the end of the matter.
It's a difficult question to answer. And anybody that tells you that it's easy to answer and they have the correct answer is probably dangerous. You know, it's like, it's something that you have to be kind of subtle and careful about. You know, I don't think the right really has a good answer to it just yet, but I think we're going to work our way there. It's eventually we will get there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I hope so. Okay, and there were two questions from Eric, and he said, what do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Well, look, it's been a long time since I dwelt in such matters, so I can't give you an off-the-cuff answer that does the question justice. But, I would have to answer it theoretically, like a lot of people would. And I would say that, you know, the lowest depth of misery is probably when you don't even care whether you survive or not, when you don't even care whether you go on, whether you kill yourself or not. But I'm not sure that anyone ever could get that miserable. And then, of course, the irony is that a person could be in a very good state of mind and have the same attitude. I don't care whether I live or die. It's ironic. I don't know. I really don't know what to say to that question. What the lowest depth of misery? I guess when you just don't see any hope in anything, when all of your hopes are, you know, any sort of cause for optimism is immediately neutralized. But that's what depression does to you. That's what depression does to your thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the weird thing about depression is that, like, you can know with certainty that you've got it and that it's some sort of a chemical imbalance happening in your brain. But even knowing that doesn't help, right? Like, even if it's sort of like if you know it's an illusion, it doesn't change the fact that you're still feeling it. To me, it would probably be like being like a burn victim, you know, or something like that. I would totally travel to a place where you could get a voluntary euthanasia or whatever, and I would definitely go that route. Like if I was in constant pain, I would do that.
Right, you've answered the question more practically than it didn't even occur to me. Like if we can answer it that way, if he's asking that, what would I regard as the worst situation to be in? Yeah, I mean, paralyzed. Quadriplegic. Losing my hands. You know, these sorts of things are just horrendous. Losing my tongue. Yeah, you know, these are things that terrify me. Really terrify me. And always have done.
Yeah.
These being disabled in a fundamental way, which means that you can no longer interact on a reasonable, equal level with everyone else. I think that would just be an endlessly crushing experience. I would absolutely hate that. So, yes, a disturbing topic. But, yeah, that's what I would personally regard as a situation where, I mean, I wouldn't blame anyone for killing themselves if they were in a situation like that. I mean, how could you hold that against them? I guess if you were religious, you could, but you know, I'm not. So I, at least not in any standard way. So I know I would, I mean, the thing is, you know, we have this attitude that with animals, like where you put it out of its misery, you know, that this lame dog that's suffering all the time. I kind of think we should have the same attitude with people. But you know, if someone's existence is just endless misery and pain, why do we demand that be elongated? And I understand that this is actually a huge moral, ethical, spiritual, religious question. But I don't think there should be black and white answers to this. I think it's to insist that someone continue to live in pain and misery I think it almost is selfish. I think it's almost like I need you to keep suffering so that my morals are sustained. Well, fuck your morals. That you're yeah. not the, you're the this person is suffering. What difference? What are your morals worth here? Why do your scruples have to be serviced here? But then I do understand also the other side of this, which is, well, should that individual suffering be allowed to commit suicide, thus rupturing the moral code of the whole community? It's one of these things where it's something that should, that there are no black and white answers here. It's something that should be done, but it should not be, we should not be proud of it. It's like, well, there are some situations where I think abortion is permissible. I think it's the right thing, but it doesn't mean that we should be fucking happy about it.
Right. Yeah. It's, nobody commits suicide, you know, for the heck of it or just, you know, just for the fun of it. It's, there's clearly, something particular happening with them that causes them to do it. And so it's, I'm kind of, in agreement with like the transhumanists, when it comes to this sort of thing. I think that longer term, we need to be looking at ways to, eliminate depression and eliminate sort of any kind of, I'm very interested in the subject of like eliminating pain. There are certain people who are actually born without the gene that causes people to have pain, to sense pain. And so I was reading an article about this woman who was born without that gene, and she would regularly, when she was younger, she would accidentally burn herself, and she had no idea that she had burned her hand or whatever. Because her brain didn't pick up on the pain. And to me, that's like, that would be heaven. Like, I think it'd be great to not sense real pain like that. But, you know, I know some people might disagree with that. But anyway, that's just an idea.
That's interesting. So you have some sympathy with the transhumanism stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah, I mean, I do as well, actually. And I've talked about this, but you know, what I don't have sympathy with is the totalitarianism and the tyranny. I just want to make that absolutely clear.
Right.
I don't want Bill Gates being in charge of my biology.
Right.
Just to be clear about that. Or Klaus Schwab or Jeff Bezos or any of these monsters.
Oh my God. Klaus Schwab is the most interesting guy of all to me, because it's like I've been watching videos about him and reading about his history and stuff, and these people who tend to kind of are drawn to these internationalist organizations like the World Economic Forum and stuff, they've clearly got a screw loose. Like, they've clearly got something going on that's causing them to crave immense power over as many people as possible. it's really fascinating, like psychologically, what's going on with them. I think Henry Kissinger is another one.
Henry Kissinger. Yes.
Yeah. He's probably one of the original globalist types. But there was another one I was reading about who was, I wish I could remember his name, but he was a scammer. He was a Canadian businessman, and he was caught like scamming people out of millions of dollars. But after being a scammer and being caught and being forced to, pay a bunch of fines, he then went on to go work for and actually he was in charge of the World Economic Forum. So it's like he just went from being this nobody businessman who was completely shamed and shunned to being the guy in charge of the WEF. And it's just like, it's just so strange to me that people can make that leap. There's definitely psychopathy or something going on there.
Yeah, it would sound likely. This is a whole area that I would like to get into. Because I think it's right that we try to understand those who are, in power, who are in control. Mm-hmm. Psychologically, there was an article published on Countercurrents. I read it actually just today. about this very topic. I can't remember what it was called. Hold on a second. I'll find out because I linked it to someone. Oh, yeah. Who actually governs us? A sociologist's view.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
And that's quite an interesting one. So that's something that people might want to have a look at. I'll link it in the Odyssey page. Here we go. There we go. Okay, and the other question from... we actually got onto talking about billionaires and so on from what do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? I don't know how we got into that. But anyway.
That always happens. Whenever I get on these things, I always end up taking tangents, and I know I shouldn't. I'm sorry.
All right. So the other question from Eric is, who are your heroes in real life? I honestly can't really think. My heroes are the people I regard the most highly are people who aren't really relevant to this movement. It's people who are very good at a craft. There's an animator in Britain called Oliver Postgate, who made things in his shed. He just made actual animations for kids' TV in his shed. And I just, he built his own tools to do this. He built his own mechanisms and then he made everything himself, everything. And I just think that's fantastic. I just think that's wonderful.
Oliver Postgate.
Yeah. American.
So he was doing like claymation with like animation or.
Yeah. Stop motion, okay. Puppetry. That sort of thing, but he built everything himself, him and his friend, his colleague, was it David Furman? And so that is someone that I just find endlessly admirable because he made it all himself, everything from nothing. And I just find that wonderful. Similar would be Stanley Kubrick because he, as I understand it, and Ridley Scott actually in a similar way, although I don't actually like his films very much, but I do, and James Cameron, same thing. I don't like most of his films. I don't think that he's actually a very, he's terrible with characters. He's terrible with characterization. But he is a very skilled craftsman, and so is Ridley Scott, and so was Stanley Kubrick. These are men who really knew what they were doing, knew the machines that they were working with, the way a camera works. They knew this in depth. And so, again, it's a similar thing where someone has mastered not just a craft, but an industry, like every job in the filming studio, they know it inside and out. I find that just extremely admirable. So those are people who, like someone who has conquered a field like that, and someone who is able, who has gathered all the skills necessary to create something on his own. That would be.
Would you consider who's the guy who created Star Wars? I forgot his name.
George Lucas.
Yeah. Would you put him in the same category or no?
I don't know what his experience is of different roles in the film studio, on the film crew. I'm not sure about that. I've only seen the original Star Wars trilogy and two Indiana Jones films. I haven't seen his other stuff, so I wouldn't know about that.
He did an interesting film before Star Wars called THX.
Oh yes,
and it had some number
1138. I've heard of it. I've never seen it, either version. I know that there are two versions because he did it as a student film.
Yeah, I watched that a while ago. I thought it was pretty good. Actually, it was really. You might like it. I think. But anyway.
I've heard of it. And then he did American Graffiti, which, again, I haven't seen.
Okay.
And then he did Star Wars. But, yeah, I'm not familiar. I mean, I don't know his stuff very well. But, yeah, so Kubrick, I can't remember. They're Ridley Scott and James Cameron. Ridley Scott, I said earlier that I don't like his films very much. I'm not just trying to be different there. I really think that he's dreadful with characters. The only film where... He was good with characters was Alien, and I think that was largely accidental. In every other film, because I think he just chose very good actors. I mean, there's a fantastic cast of very talented actors.
Well, that's the case with a lot of directors, because it's like, You know, what was that guy? Peter Jackson, who did the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Oh, yeah.
But before he did Lord of the Rings, he did some film about lesbians or something. I forgot what it was called.
Oh, yes. I've actually seen part of it.
Did you?
I think it's called Bound.
Okay. Yeah, it was something. I didn't see it. But anyway, it's I just remember thinking, like, I was reading about him, and I remember thinking, that is so strange that they picked him to direct Lord of the Rings after he did such a weird, you know, his film history was so strange and totally unrelated to like fantasy fiction like that. And
yeah, it wasn't Bound. That was something else. I'm looking at his IMDb now, and I can't see which one it would have been. But yeah, I see what you mean. And also that just the scale of that production was massive compared to, I think prior to that, he'd done mostly very low budget films.
Well, that's another thing is, you know, he had, what he did was he came up with a 30-minute reel basically of scenes from Hobbiton, you know, that he had filmed with the actors. And this was before, this was when he was sort of like pitching himself as the director. And so he took this 30-minute reel to a bunch of people who worked at the studio, and they watched it, and they were just stunned at how amazingly good he had done with making the hobbits look smaller than Gandalf. and yet he explained that it was like the camera angles and everything, but it's like the fact that he was so good at it, they said, okay, we're going to double the budget for the movies. And they said also, initially they were only just going to do two movies. And then they said, well, we'll make it three. You know, we'll go ahead and have one movie per book. So, but yeah, that's all.
Yeah, that kind of thing I really admire. I mean, I love when someone is able to do something impressive with few resources or with meager resources.
Yeah.
I think it's something that just excites me very, very much.
Right.
So someone, like, for example, the story I always tell about this is that in the Terminator, the first film, 1984, mm-hmm. The final shot of the Terminator was done. It's actually tinfoil, a tiny LED bulb, two pieces of styrofoam, and a guy smoking a cigarette off screen. And that's how they got the final shot, where the eye switches off, the red eye switches off, and that's the Terminator dying. That was done for like what, $10 or something.
Wow,
it's just nothing, and I find that just fantastic. You know, it's like, oh shit, they realized in the editing rooms that, oh shit, we don't have a shot of it actually dying. We don't have the moment of death. So what do we do? And they were able to solve the problem with just tiny resources, and I just think that's fantastic. It really excites me, and so whenever I hear about something like that, I think, oh wow, that's amazing. So that's the kind of thing that I really admire, and as for heroes in real life, it would be people who are able to do things like that. Something impressive is done with a tiny budget.
Yeah,
like one of my favorite films is With Nil and I, which is just a tiny budget. I mean, compared to the crap that is made nowadays for like $100 million, and it's absolute garbage. You know, I just think, well, With Nil and I is a masterpiece, and it was done for a couple of million.
Mm-hmm.
It's just nothing really. And that, you know, that's what, that seems to be I think that's what craft should be about, really, is making the most out of small resources. And whenever someone masters that, the ability, you know, the skills involved in doing that, and masters disparate skills in order to synthesize them into some unique way. I just find that fantastic. So those are the people that are my heroes. Those are the people I admire the most. As for my heroes, that's a different thing. And I don't really have any. I have people who have influenced me a lot, but so does everyone. So, I mean, Carl, do you want to take a stab at this question? Who are your heroes?
That's a tough one. I mean, I would say the ones that pop to my mind first is like Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh. I like those two guys. I think the fact that they were able to become so successful in their respective fields, and also speak in defense of the European people and speak in defense of what they cared about, even though it was unpopular even back then, that's meaningful. And then I would say, like, people who are, I know, like, the medical industry is maligned now for obvious reasons, but I think, like, people who actually come up with genuine progress and you know, surgeons and people, you know, like, for instance, the robotics that improve and make surgery possible, I think that that's just a really big deal. Like, people who can improve people's quality of life, and also, like, you know, John Muir and people who care about the environment and natural habitats of animals. I care about that. So, but yeah, as heroes, that's a tough one to answer. I think as you get older, you realize that there's really no such thing as a real hero. You're just kind of, there's, you know, people who are admirable to a greater degree.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think when you're younger, it's easier to be sort of bowled over and just think that someone's fantastic. When, as you get older, you get more less impressible and more realistic, right. And you think, but then that makes you admire people more in a more sort of sincere way, because you realize what they actually had to overcome in order to do that thing. Yeah. But so you have a more real, more honest appreciation of them. But you don't think they're fantastic. You don't think they're, you know, like gods among men.
Right. Right.
So, yeah. Well, okay, let's leave it at that, because we've actually gone 6 minutes over. So I don't know, Greg might be furious with me for doing that. But we wanted to finish that question. So, okay, well, Carl, where can people find you?
You can find me on Telegram. It's t.me, and I believe it's, let me check it real quick, because I changed it recently, and it was just to make
Carl.
It. Yeah, Bitcoin Carl. It's t.me/BitcoinCarl. Carl with a K. That's my channel.
And there's no space or hyphen or whatever. It's just the two words. So that's there. And I'm the same, t.me/MillennialWoes or MillennialWoes.com, or there's the Odyssey channel. On my Telegram channel, every Monday night at around this exact time, 10 p.m. GMT, every Monday night, I do a hangout on there. So that's something that people might want to listen in on. And all right, well, that's me. And I guess that's it. So, all right, thank you for tuning in. I hope this was, I hope I did okay. And maybe I'll do this again in the future at some point. But in the meantime, thanks everyone for tuning in. See you all later.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.